organs. They get rid of their choirs. So you have a tiny little Reformed Baptist movement in this country of about 24 dead musicless churches.
Because if you have any wavering in your confidence about the integrity of your translation of the Bible, it'll suck the conviction right out of your heart.
And that leads to some very interesting, heretical, and very important conclusions.
Well, I want to welcome you back to Word Magazine. Yes, this is Word Magazine, the commentary coming to you from Jeff Riddle. That's me, pastor, church planter of Christ Reformed Baptist Church in Charlottesville, Virginia. Today is Tuesday, July 16, 2013. I'm sitting here in a classroom space at the Jefferson Center in downtown Charlottesville, Virginia, a class where later on tonight I'll be teaching a community college course on the New Testament and early Christianity. But I thought maybe it was time we did another one of these Word magazines. I had high hopes that I would be able to be more frequent in doing these little commentaries, these little audio commentaries. But I just have not had the time to do it. In fact, I look back on our sermon audio account and noticed that I had not done a Word magazine since October the 11th of 2012, when the Dalai Lama came to Charlottesville, and I and a friend went out and had some conversations with some of the folks who had assembled for that. That's the last Word magazine that I did. I keep hoping that I would have time, maybe weekly, or at least every couple of weeks, to sit down and do one of these. But it's just a matter of being busy. I hate personally to complain about being busy, because we all have the same amount of time, and we all have the stewardship of the same amount of time. I don't have any more or any less than you do. But we find ways to fill up our time. Of course, I'm laboring it and got my irons in a number of fires. Most importantly, laboring as a pastor of a local church congregation. We had a wonderful Lord's Day on Sunday. Even for us, it was a particularly busy Sabbath. I was involved in four different services on Sunday. We had our regular Lord's Day morning worship, 10:30 in the morning, where I had the privilege of preaching from Luke 11, verses 1 through 13, on the subject, Lord, teach us to pray, looking at Luke's account of Jesus teaching on the Lord's Prayer. And then on the second Sundays, our schedule's a bit different. We had a Sunday school lesson after lunch, and I led that Sunday school lesson where we went back and looked in a little more depth at the Lucan Lord's Prayer account, comparing it with the version of the Lord's Prayer that is recounted in Matthew, and asking some questions about what the origins of this were. Were these two versions of the same teaching? And I rejected that. I said, no, these were two different occasions. Matthew has an independent record of Jesus teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, and Luke has a record of another teaching at another time when Jesus uses substantially the same words in the Sermon on the Mount, but in some ways a little bit different as well. And so I taught on that. We talked a little bit about the translation, the text and translation, and then we got into the spiritual, the practical. Should you use prayers like the Lord's Prayer? Should those be repeated liturgically, corporately in worship? After all, it is Scripture. We're reciting Scripture, but it can also become mechanical, as in, say, the Roman Catholic tradition. Or, you know, go say a certain number of Our Fathers, and you can do penance for particular sins or so forth. We, of course, reject that type of view of the use of the Lord's Prayer. But it was a good good discussion. We had some visitors with us, including a family coming all the way down from Delaware, who regularly listened to our sermons and been following, in particular, the afternoon series that we've been doing through the Baptist Catechism. And so you never know who's out there listening and what kind of bonds that you can make, fraternal bonds you can make with believers. And so it's pretty amazing to be able to broadcast and then communicate with people later as well. Then that afternoon, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, as we do every second Lord's Day of the month, I had the privilege of preaching out at the Our Lady of Peace Retirement Center. It's a retirement center that's owned by the Roman Catholic Diocese here, but it's a secular, managed by a secular agency, and there are people of all different confessional backgrounds, and they have a Protestant worship service there on Sunday afternoons. I've been preaching out there for a number of years on the second Sunday, and have enjoyed getting to know some of the dear brethren who are out there, and for some of them, this is the only church service they're able to go to during a week. A lot of times, the speakers that speak there are from primarily mainline Protestant churches, Methodist, and so forth. And some of them do appreciate the one Sunday a month when we're able to be there and represent a more conservative, traditional brand of Christianity. And I preached on from Mark 15 about the trial of Jesus before Pilate and the exchange for Barabbas. I've been doing a series out there. It's month breaks at a time, but I've been going through the account of the Passion of Christ. It started with the Lord's Supper, moved on to the Garden of Gethsemane, and Jesus arrested in the garden, and the trial before the Sanhedrin, the betrayal by Peter, and we went one step further this past Sunday, preaching about Barabbas, and in particular introducing and talking about the idea of the substitutionary atonement of Christ, how that account of Barabbas in some ways stands forward as speaking to the substitutionary death of Christ, how we are like Barabbas, sinners, and Christ has stood in our place. And then to top it off on Sunday, fourthly then, we were out at 7 o'clock in the evening at the Fluvanna Women's Prison, and I had the privilege of preaching there. We were joking about it. There were about 15 of us from our church who went out there for the service, but we decided it was the largest corporate worship service of Christ Reformed Baptist Church because there were about 250 inmates, and then there were the guards and staff who happened to be there as well, gathered in the gym there, and we were able to lead in worship. We were able to introduce some psalm singing, which I don't think they've ever done before there, and sort of regulative principle worship. And then I had the opportunity to preach again from the Gospel of Luke, from this time from Luke 10, and the parable of the Good Samaritan. So it was a busy day on Sunday, lots of good ministry, and very enjoyable. But one of the things that happened on Sunday morning, I am normally a very regular listener to National Public Radio. And I know some people, like my good friend Bob Washburn up in Connecticut, would say, "Jeff, why do you listen to that?" And I always think of what Cal Thomas said when I heard him speak at a pregnancy pro-life banquet a few years ago. He said every day or every morning he reads the New York Times and the Bible because he wants to see what both sides are up to. No, I enjoy listening to NPR. I often don't agree, often profoundly disagree with the perspective, often laugh at the perspective, so much so that my family, when we're sometimes listening to it over breakfast, we train the kids in discernment, and they can point out some of the gaps in logic and the bias. But then there are also often some very good things that are there too, interesting things. But I happened to have the radio on when I was getting ready for church Sunday morning, as I was getting dressed, shaving, getting dressed. I don't normally do that, to be honest, because I listen to NPR just about every morning Monday through Saturday. One of the ways that I make Sunday a little bit different for me is I don't listen to NPR on Sundays. But I had happened to turn it on because I wanted to hear what they had to say about the George Zimmerman verdict. And it just so happened, I heard just the quick reaction to that, but what caught my ear was the mention of the fact that they were going to do a short interview relating to a new book on Jesus of Nazareth. And so that caught my ear, and I started to listen to a little bit of it. I didn't have time to listen to all of it, although the segment was only about 9 minutes long. And then Monday morning, I pulled it up online and went to their archive and listened to the little article, the audio article that was there on the Sunday morning weekend edition of NPR. And then I noticed later in the day that they had the same author of this book on for the program that comes on in the afternoon called Fresh Air. And they had another extended interview with him about his book on Jesus. And I thought that I might try to play some of the segment from Sunday morning and give some interaction with it. I've kind of become interested in the topic of what is sometimes called the search for the historical Jesus or the quest of the historical Jesus. Mainly because I taught a class last spring at our community college here on the life and teachings of Jesus. And in order to prepare for that class, I had to do quite a bit of reading, get myself up to speed on the history of research into the life of Jesus and where sort of the contemporary question is. Quite frankly, this had not been a subject I've been particularly interested in. Of course, I'm interested in the Gospels. I'm interested in their presentation of Jesus, but I've been less interested in sort of the scholarly, modern historical critical, post 1800 quest of the historical Jesus. But I have become interested in it mainly because of that class, and I might likely teach that class again, perhaps next spring. And, of course, this book is right down the alley of this. The book is by a fellow named Reza Aslan. And that's Aslan, A-S-L-A-N, just like Aslan in the C.S. Lewis books, Lion, Witch, and Wardrobe. Although he is, the author of the book is not certainly not an Aslan character. The name of the book is Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. It's was just released July 16th, 2013, was the supposed release date for the book, and it comes from Random House. I looked on Amazon just a few moments ago, and it was ranked number three today. Among the best sellers, and that's pretty amazing for a book on Jesus to have such a high ranking on the Amazon list. Didn't know much about Reza Aslan until I listened to part of this interview, which we're going to play some of in just a moment, but did a little bit of research on him. Of course, it's sometimes spotty when you check things out on the internet. But these are some of the things I ran across. It seems that he's a fairly young man, apparently in his early 40s. He's an Iranian-American. I think his family came over in 1979. He would have been a child. Grew up, it looks like, in California. He's an academic, currently a visiting professor at Drew University. He's also taught at the University of California, Riverside, University of Iowa, and he is a contributing editor at the Daily Beast website. He apparently has a doctoral degree in sociology of religion and global studies from UC Santa Barbara. He studied at Harvard, I think the Divinity School, Harvard University. And so he has a religious studies background. I think he's actually an Islamic scholar. I think he made his mark with a book that was published just 2 years ago, 2011, a book about Islam titled No God But God. And it's subtitled The Origin, Evolution, and Future of Islam. And so he's looked to as an expert in that. But now he has written this book on Jesus. And his views that he puts forward in Jesus, I have not read the book. I'm going on his presentation of the ideas in this brief vignette. But he's presenting a view of Jesus that seems to be very much in line with the post-Enlightenment modern critical view of Jesus, and that is we can't know much about the historical Jesus. We have to divide the Jesus of history from the Christ of faith, and there's a big gap between who Jesus is and what he taught and what early Christians with the so-called Easter faith preached about him. And so this is his basic perspective. But why don't we start off and just listen to a little bit of this segment that came from the Sunday, July 14 edition, weekend edition from NPR. And I'll interrupt with a few comments along the way. Here we go.
When religious scholar Reza Aslan was 15, he went with some of his friends to an evangelical Christian camp. And it was there that he heard the story of the gospel and of Jesus Christ. It was a profound experience for him, and he immediately converted to Christianity. But later, when he went to college and started looking at the Bible as an academic, he started having doubts. The more I started studying...
Let me just pause here for a moment and... This is very interesting. Apparently, this is part of his biography. As a young teen, he went to some sort of Christian camp and had a so-called conversion experience. But, as the interviewer says, then when he went to college and started studying in the field of religion, he lost his faith. And in some ways, this reminds me of the narrative of another academic, Bart Ehrman, who teaches at the University of North Carolina and is a prolific author, has popularized a lot of modern critical historical study of the Bible that has cast doubts on the integrity, the historicity of the New Testament. And Ehrman likewise claims that as a teenager he made a profession of faith and was an evangelical born-again Christian, even went to Moody Bible College, Bart Ehrman did. And then though he went to Princeton and he started studying the Bible and studying modern historical criticism, and particularly it was his study of the text of the Bible, which he did with a fellow named Bruce Metzger, an expert in the field. And it sort of shattered his beliefs about the Bible because, according to him, he found out that God had not preserved the Bible. And so he abandoned his Christian confession and became an agnostic. And, of course, our response to that is that most likely Mr. Aslan, like Mr. Ehrman, in fact, never was a Christian. He was somebody who perhaps made an outward external profession of faith, but obviously he has not persevered in the faith, and therefore he has shown that he was not truly regenerate. He is like those that are described by Jesus in his parable of the sower, found in Mark 4 and Matthew 13. Those where the seed falls on shallow soil and springs up and seems to have life for a season, but then the sun scorches it out, or like the seed that falls among the thorns and springs up, but then it's choked out by the cares and concerns of the world, by the weeds and the thorns. And so we would call this a false profession. Not a genuine profession, as opposed to somebody who was a Christian started being a Christian and stopped being one. The Bible teaches, we believe, that if one is truly converted, he will persevere in the faith. As Paul puts it in Philippians, he who began a good work in you will be faithful to complete it. So that's just an observation from the get-go. This is another person who claims to have been a Christian and then fell away when he went to college. I might add on this, whereas Bart Ehrman says that the thing that dislodged his supposed faith was his text-critical study of the Bible. In this case, according to Mr. Aslan, it was his study of the historical Jesus, perhaps his study of the Gospels, that dislodged his faith. And there is a cautionary tale here. There are lots of people who do go off to a university and they take an introductory religion course and they have a sort of a very naive and Sunday school surface level knowledge, lots of moralisms, maybe they've been in the youth group and they've had lots of pizza parties and not really studied the Bible with seriousness, with earnestness, and that kind of person can get into an academic religion course, and if they're believers, they can have their faith challenged. If they were false professors, they can just be pushed out of that into outright agnosticism, which apparently happened with this man. And I've talked to a number of students through the years. I live here in a university town. I've had young men and women who were college students at the University of Virginia attend my church. And of course, I'm teaching myself in a community college setting. And I often tell them, when you take a religion course in a university, you've set yourself up for what is essentially, I'd call it, an unfair fight. I mean, you come in as an 18, 19, 20-year-old knowing, in truth, very little about the Bible. And the person in the classroom is someone who's older than you. They're more mature, at least chronologically, than you. They have earned a PhD from an accredited university, if they're teaching in an accredited school. If it's in the area of Bible, they know Hebrew, they know Greek, they know Aramaic. And if it's in a secular university, they have been steeped in the historical critical method. And it's going to be kind of an unfair fight. You're not going to meet with that person on equal ground. And if they have an interest in, they don't approach any class they're teaching without bias. They're not going to lay everything out even on the table. You don't have enough time in a course really to be able to fully measure and weigh all the options. And they're going to present a particular viewpoint. I tell my students all the time, I want to explain to them what various opinions are, but I'll let it be known. I hold to traditional Christian views. And I think you can do that fairly. Sometimes people who don't hold to traditional Christian views are not always as upfront about that. And it sounds like perhaps this young man got into religion classes in college, and the surface level faith or non-faith, as it was, that he had was easily dislodged. And instead, deep skepticism came in. And there may be some other issues here. I don't know fully about this man, where he stands in relationship to Islam. He may be like many apologists for Islam, in that they sort of gleefully take up higher critical enlightenment criticism of Jesus of Nazareth, but they are unwilling to apply those same critical standards to the study of the Quran or the study of the life of Muhammad, etc. But let's move on. We just got through the interviewer's introduction, and she was asking him about his background, and he's beginning to give an answer. So let's listen to him continue.
The historical Jesus, the man who lived 2,000 years ago, and tumultuous eras in the history of the Holy Land, which frankly is saying a lot, the more I started to realize that there was this chasm between the historical Jesus and the Jesus that I had been taught about.
Well, again, I'm going to interrupt here. What he's talking about is this so-called great chasm between the Jesus of history and the so-called Christ of faith. And of course, that is a dichotomy. I believe it's a false dichotomy that's often drawn in the academic classroom, study of the New Testament, study of early Christianity, between supposedly who the real Jesus was and the later invention of the early church. Sometimes people will say, you know, Jesus was the founder of the simple Christianity, you know, love your neighbor and love your enemies. And then Paul came along and made it a religion about the atonement and the resurrection and the cross and so forth. But I believe that that is a false dichotomy. You can both uphold the historical Jesus and you can uphold the Christ of faith. Those two are not mutually exclusive, and we don't have to assume that those two are mutually exclusive. But let's continue.
In church, and now years later, Reza Aslan has written a biography of Jesus of Nazareth. Aslan stopped at our studio at NPR West, and I asked him what he meant when he wrote about the difference between Jesus of Nazareth and Jesus Christ.
Obviously, there are billions of Christians in the world who believe that Jesus of Nazareth is the living incarnation of God. And that's a perfectly fine belief. But
I'm very thankful that he is open-minded enough to say that the Orthodox view of Jesus is a perfectly valid belief. I'm not sure he really holds that opinion genuinely, but let's continue and hear what he has to say.
Whatever else he was, whether he was the Messiah or God or what have you, he was also a man. He was a human being.
I want to stop right here. Christians do not deny that Jesus was a man. In fact, it is a fundamental part of Orthodoxy to say that Jesus was fully man. According to what we call Chalcedonian Christology, we also affirm with equal vigor that he was fully God. One person with two natures, fully God and fully man. But the implication of what he's saying is that Orthodox Christians don't uphold the full humanity of Jesus. Yes, we do. And we uphold the full historicity of Jesus. Jesus was not some phantom. He wasn't some ethereal spirit. There was an early heresy rejected by Orthodox teachers. It was called Docetism, the Docetic view that saw Jesus as being so otherworldly that he wasn't really a human being, didn't really suffer on the cross, etc. And that is not a view that Orthodox Christians have ever held or promoted. Let's continue.
He was a man who lived in a specific time, an era that was marked by the slow burn of a Jewish revolt against the Roman Empire that would ultimately result in the year 66 CE in the success of actually throwing Rome out of the Holy Land and keeping them at bay for 3.5-4 long years. Of course, in 70 CE, the Romans returned and ended up destroying Jerusalem.
What he's talking about here is just setting the life of Jesus within the history of first century Palestine. Yes, there was a revolt by the Jews against Rome that resulted in the destruction of Jerusalem and the destruction of the temple in 70 AD. And Mr. Aslan is going to go on and argue that Jesus was, the historical Jesus was somehow involved in zealotry, that he was at work to attempt to overthrow Roman rule. And in some ways, it reminds me of the old expression, there's nothing new under the sun. This is not, although it's being presented on NPR as some kind of a new idea, it's really not a new idea. Ever since the Enlightenment, from time to time, there have been scholars who have popped up who have made this kind of argument. In fact, more recently, back in the late 60s, there was a scholar named Brandon who wrote a book called Jesus and the Zealots, where he made a very similar type of argument. And so this really isn't, you know, groundbreaking material that Mr. Aslan is reviewing. And, of course, I don't hold that Jesus was a zealot. I think there are many arguments against Jesus being a zealot. In fact, when it lists the disciples of Jesus, there's at least one man among them, Simon, who is described as Simon the Zealot, meaning that formerly he had been a zealot, but he had left that in order to be a follower of Jesus. Certainly the teaching that Jesus gives in the Sermon on the Mount, where he says that his followers are to turn the other cheek, to carry the pack of the Roman soldier even a second mile, the fact that he, when arrested, doesn't retaliate, doesn't fight, tells his disciples to put away their swords, the fact that he tells Pilate when he is on trial, my kingdom is not of this world, would argue against Jesus being the kind of zealot that I think Mr. Aslan probably wants to present him as. But let's continue a little bit more of what he has to say.
Burning the temple to the ground, slaughtering hundreds of thousands of Jews and scattering the rest to the winds. We should say CE is common era.
CE is common era. That's right, Ed, instead of AD.
The interviewer there just qualified his language. It's common, if you're not familiar with it, in contemporary academic study of the Bible, whether the Hebrew Bible, the Old Testament, the New Testament, to instead of using the language of B.C., before Christ, or A.D., Anno Domini, in the year of our Lord, many modern scholars prefer instead to use the expression B.C.E., before the Common Era, and C.E., the Common Era, as substitutes for B.C. and A.D., so they can sort of de-Christianize the language. I've always thought it's a kind of peculiar thing, because they're still using the birth of Jesus as the benchmark for dividing history. And can we really talk about there being a common era in the time after the birth of Jesus? There's diversity in religion and politics. There's, you know, Judaism and then Christianity and then later on Islam. I'm not sure we can really talk about a common era. Why not just use the traditional language? When somebody says uses the term AD and they're not a Christian, we don't expect that that is some sort of a confession of faith that they're making, that they believe in the Lord or they believe this is the year of the Lord, any more than when we say Thursday, that we are acknowledging Thor and saying that it is Thor's day. But anyways, a little pet peeve of mine, I prefer to use B.C. and A.D. rather than B.C.E. And B.C. or C.E. rather. Let's go a little further.
What I think is important for Christians to understand is that every gospel story written about Jesus of Nazareth was written after that event.
Whoa, let's stop right there. This is a huge assumption. I don't know if you caught that. What he's saying is he wants Christians to understand that every one of the Gospels was written after the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem in 70 AD. My question for Mr. Aslan is, how do you know that with any measure of certainty? And the answer is, you do not know that. None of the canonical Gospels have within them any means of specifically recording the date at which they were written. In fact, many people believe that they were written before 70 AD precisely because there is no direct mention in the Gospels of the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. Some scholars will try to make arguments. They'll look at the teaching of Jesus on the Mount of Olives, the so-called Olivet Discourse, and they will argue that the gospel writers have read into their inferences and references to the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem. sort of after the fact prophecies that are put in there. But this is entirely speculative. Again, there was a point 100 or 150 years ago at the height of Enlightenment skepticism of the Gospels when many people radically dated the Gospels to the 2nd and 3rd century. Unfortunately for them, manuscript discoveries of the Bible have dated it earlier and earlier and earlier. John's Gospel, for example, used to be dated very, very late by critical scholars and thought to have no historical value until the so-called John Ryland's fragment, P52, was discovered. And it's a little fragment of the Gospel of John, just a few verses, but it's definitely from the Gospel of John. And it's been dated to 125 A.D. It's one of the earliest pieces of the New Testament manuscripts that we have. And it obviously sets the Gospel of John as being used in the early second century. Most, even skeptical scholars today, will date the Gospel of Mark, which they believe is first, and we'll come back to that in just a moment, as being in the 60s. And then beyond that, the traditions that are in the Gospels that have been recorded by the evangelists, by the Gospel writers, go back to Jesus himself. That is, they go back to the ministry of Jesus decades earlier. And these traditions have been faithfully preserved by the apostles and by Christians. And so it is entirely speculative and inaccurate to say that the Gospels were all written after 70. He has absolutely no historical ground to say that with any certainty at all. Let me continue.
Apocalyptic event which for Jews signaled the end of the world as they knew it. And that matters, because not only is the context in which Jesus lived important in understanding who he is, but the context in which the words that we have that were written about him were written is also important in figuring out how this marginal, illiterate...
Oops, let me pause right here. Did you catch that? Let me go back to one thing. He said, first of all, that there's a difference between the context in which Jesus spoke the words and did the things recorded in his ministry and the context in which the Gospels were written. So he wants to put a divide between the historical Jesus and the theological reflection upon Jesus in the early church, which he believes is the setting for the Gospels. And of course, from a traditional perspective, we would say there is no such gap. The Gospels faithfully record what Jesus actually did and what Jesus actually said. And then right at the very end, I don't know if you caught that, let me maybe go back to it a little bit and see if we can catch it one more time. Here we go.
It's also important in figuring out how this marginal, illiterate, uneducated Jew from the low hills of Galilee, who was executed as a state criminal, ultimately became known as God incarnate.
So, did you catch that? Jesus is a marginal, illiterate Jew from the hill country. And the thing that I pause there again on is the fact that he called Jesus illiterate. That's amazing, given if the Gospels have any historical credibility. In Luke chapter 4, Jesus stands up in the synagogue and he reads from the prophet Isaiah. He obviously has read the Old Testament, is very familiar with the Old Testament. He quotes it often. I think it's a huge leap, a huge inaccurate leap to say that Jesus of Nazareth was illiterate. Maybe he meant that in the sort of way that in the book of Acts, in Acts 4:13, it says that the apostles were illiterate or unlearned men, agramatoi, though they took note of the fact that they had been with Jesus. But certainly it would be inaccurate to say that Jesus was illiterate. And then you could sort of see the influence, I think, of John Dominic Cresson, upon Mr. Ashland seeing Jesus as a sort of a peasant, a homeland Jewish peasant. Again, the simple Jesus who his simple gospel has been turned into something that he didn't intend by the early church. This is sort of the mindset is behind his observations. Let's go a little further.
Which is really interesting, right? Because the common understanding of Jesus was that he was this kind of quiet man, had this ethereal quality, carrying this message about salvation. But you describe Jesus as a revolutionary, a political figure, not so quiet. In particular, you pull out the story of Jesus and the money changers.
Yeah, so of course.
Well, he's going to go on here in just a moment and talk about Jesus overturning the tables of the money changers, and he's going to see this as kind of the example par excellence of Jesus being a revolutionary, and Jesus wanted to overthrow the temple and overthrow the Roman government, etc. It's interesting that he sort of seems to pick and choose what parts of the gospels he believes are historical and which are not. If we apply his general standard, how do we know that Jesus actually went into the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers? And of course, I believe he did because it's recorded in the Gospels. But I'm not sure it's what he interprets it to be. It seems to me that it was more of a prophetic act, like the prophets of old, a symbolic act. And wasn't necessarily an act related to the Romans, but related to purity of worship and how that there had been degradation, degeneracy in that area, and Jesus had come to restore purity of worship. It's also interesting to note that according to John's Gospel, Jesus went into the temple and cleared out the money changers very early in his ministry. According to Matthew, Mark, and Luke, then he went into the temple just before his crucifixion. So most traditional scholars believe there were actually two occasions when Jesus cleansed the temple. And the first one, recorded in John, did not result in his arrest. The second one, when he was in Jerusalem for the final Passover before his crucifixion did follow, but nowhere in the Gospels does it connect the dots between because he cleansed the temple, he was seen as a threat and he was arrested. There were many other encounters that Jesus has with the religious authorities aside from the so-called cleansing of the temple. It's completely speculative and ahistorical to leap and say that this was the most important thing or this was the pivotal thing that happened that led to Jesus' arrest. But let's go ahead and listen to the rest of his analysis of it.
Jesus walks into the temple and he begins to cleanse it. He overturns the tables of the money changers who are exchanging the foul foreign currency of the Roman Empire with the Hebrew shekel, which was the only currency that the temple would accept. And of course, in a loud, booming voice, he says, "It is written that my house shall be a house of prayer for all nations, and you have made it a den of thieves."
I don't know that it says, that's another read-in, that Jesus spoke with a loud, booming voice. Perhaps he did. I think it says perhaps he cried out. But this would be another way of, I think Mr. Aslan has a tendency to go beyond what is written and sort of read in his speculations into it. But let's continue.
Now, as all historians recognize, this was the action that precipitated his arrest.
Again, false. As all historians recognize, no, that is not a point at which all historians agree, and that's across the board. That's not a point that all members of the modern academy would agree with, people who are not approaching the life of Jesus from a confessional perspective, and it's a misrepresentation to say that there's unanimity on this topic.
By the state. And there's a very simple reason for that. The temple was not just the
center of the Jewish cult. It was, in many ways, the representation of the power and the presence of the Roman Empire. So any attack on the temple would have been seen as an attack on the Roman Empire. And frankly, to really know who Jesus was, all you have to know is what happened to him at the end of his life. Crucifixion was a Roman punishment that was exclusively reserved for the crime of sedition.
Well, I agree with him that knowing about the cross of Christ is essential for understanding the identity of Jesus. You know, it was famously said by the German scholar Martin Kaler that the Gospels are passion narratives with extended introductions. So obviously the cross is very important. He's trying to stress that crucifixion was a punishment that was exclusively held for those engaged in acts of sedition. And to some degree, yes, Jesus is crucified, according to the gospel accounts, because Pilate sees him as a threat. Are you the king of the Jews? On the other hand, the Gospels also present his death as a result of the judgment of the Jewish authorities, the Sanhedrin, that Jesus had blasphemed. And so from the Jewish perspective, before the Sanhedrin, the charge against him is not sedition, but blasphemy, because he's making himself equal with God, claiming to be the Son of Man, coming in the clouds with power. Whereas from the Roman or Gentile perspective, the problem is, yes, insurrection. But from the Gospel's account, that's a false charge against Jesus. He's not an insurrectionist like Barabbas. And in fact, again, as he tells Pilate, my kingdom is not of this world. Even John Dominic Cresson, who's a very liberal New Testament scholar, I read an article by him recently in which he argued that Jesus was not a threat to the Romans. If he had been a threat, they would have been chasing down all of his disciples to arrest and execute them. But they thought that they had eliminated the Jesus movement when they eliminated Jesus. And he argues that Jesus taught nonviolence and so forth, and wants to make Jesus a social crusader. He misses the boat, I think, on both the historical Jesus and the Orthodox Jesus. But I think Cresson would be someone who would not agree with Aslan here, even though he's certainly not approaching the scriptures from a confessional perspective. Let's go a little further.
Crime of treason. As I say in the book, if you know nothing else about Jesus except that he was crucified, you know enough to understand who he was, what he meant, and why he was such a threat to the political and religious authorities of his time.
Hmm. How do you look at the Bible as a source?
I see the scriptures of the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament very much the same way that I see the scriptures of the Quran or the Gathas or the Vedas or...
You know, this sounds very good. You know, I see the Bible like I see other world scriptures, etc. That seems to be respectful, and I've heard people say that sort of thing before. On the other hand, it's not respectful. All religions are not the same. This is sort of a Joseph Campbell, who was a famous writer, religious writer, and he claimed that all religions were basically the same. I think he read a book called The God with a Thousand Faces. But inherently, all religions are not the same. Buddhism doesn't teach a personal God. It teaches that the created order is evil, and we have to get beyond the creation to the spiritual. Christianity and Judaism teach the creation is good. All religions are not the same, and all the scriptures of all the religions of the world are not the same. And to me, it's not respectful of those religions to group all their scriptures together in one lump and say that they basically are all the same. I would rather acknowledge the ways in which they have profound differences, and to do that respectfully. I agree with doing it respectfully, but let's not lump them all together.
Or what have you? I think that these scriptures are inspired by individuals.
Whoops! Let's stop right there. Scriptures are inspired by individuals. That is, I guess, a common view that what he calls the scriptures are written by sort of religious geniuses, people who have spiritual experiences, enlightened spiritual experiences, and they write down their so-called scriptures. That's not, however, the biblical view of inspiration. We could go to 2 Timothy 3:16. All scriptures are given by inspiration of God. They are theopneustos. They are God-breathed. The Christian view of inspiration is not that Matthew was inspired out of himself, sort of auto-inspiration, or that Paul was a religious genius. The idea of inspiration from a biblical perspective is that God inspired the authors of the Bible. The Apostle Peter says that holy men of old were moved by the Holy Spirit. And so this idea of scriptures, so-called, being written by inspired men is not really the terminology that we would use from a Christian perspective.
In a moment of metaphysical contact with the divine spirit, have been able to communicate something about God to us. But I also recognize as a historian that this is sacred history, not history in the way that we would think about history as a collection of observable and verifiable events and facts.
Whoops. Here we've got another point where Mr. Aslan really demonstrates for us his worldview. And that is, he wants to develop another false dichotomy. He wants to say, on one hand, we can have writings that are sacred history, and they're not interested in basic historical verifiable facts, and on the other hand, we have this sort of the real world history of how things actually happen in space and time. And he's going to make the argument that things like the Gospels and the New Testament are involved merely with sacred history and not with sort of real history. And I think the roots of this go back a long ways, and many would trace it back to the philosopher Immanuel Kant, who developed this way of looking at religious material. You can affirm that it's true in the sense of spiritually true without it having to be literally true. But those categories don't have to, again, to be mutually exclusive. The Gospels can be sacred history, and at the same time, they can be true as far as what they report with regard to historical facts, details, and dates. And another problem with this is when we read, say, the Gospels, they don't present themselves as books that don't care about facts. If you take the Gospel of Luke, for example, he's very careful to tell us that Jesus was born when Caesar Augustus was the emperor of Rome. And then when we look at the historical record, yes, Caesar Augustus was the emperor of Rome at the time of the birth of Jesus. Later on, he'll tell us that Tiberius was the Caesar who was ruling at the time when Jesus began his public ministry. And he was also the Caesar when Jesus was crucified. He'll tell us that all the Gospels will tell us that Pontius Pilate was the Roman governor of Judea at the time of the crucifixion of Jesus. Well, we know from the historical record that, yes, there was a man named Pontius Pilate who was the governor of Judea from 26 to 36 A.D. The facts that are recorded in Luke's Gospel, the historical timeline he gives, is absolutely accurate. So there doesn't have to be this division between sacred history and sort of real history that Mr. Aslan presents.
Valuable in the sense that they reveal certain truths to us, but that the facts that they reveal are not as valuable as the truths are. And so we have to look at them from a different kind of lens than I think certainly modern Christians tend to look at the scripture.
Again, I know it's a short interview, but I really would like to dialogue with him about what are the facts within the Gospels that he thinks are inaccurate, or in what way does he believe that the Gospel writers were not concerned with accuracy in what they presented. We know from sources outside of the New Testament, from like the Roman historian Tacitus, from two references in the writings of Josephus, the Jewish historian Josephus, that there was knowledge of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, and also references to the fact that he was crucified under Pontius Pilate. So from what I see, the Gospel writers are quite concerned about historical accuracy. Read the introduction to the Gospel of Luke. Read Luke 1:1-4, where Luke says he has been careful about gathering sources and he wants to give an accurate record of the life of Jesus. So I think it would be wrong to want to draw some kind of distinction between the way people in the first century would have wanted accurately to tell the story of the life of Jesus and the way a modern person would want to get the facts straight about some important historical event.
Sure. So what else then do you use? Do you point to what other sources outside of the Bible helped you construct a fuller picture of Jesus the man?
I think the main source that I use is the world in which Jesus lived, first century Palestine, a world that we know a lot about, thanks to the Romans, who were quite adept at documentation. What I argue is...
I would just say yes. I think knowing as much as we can about first century Palestine, knowing the backgrounds both in Judaism, knowing the backgrounds in the Greco-Roman world, knowing the culture, knowing things about the language, knowing the impact of Hellenization upon the ancient world, all these things are very, very important for understanding the cultural world, the social world of Jesus and of the apostles. But he seems to imply that those things are at odds with what we find within the New Testament, and I would challenge that.
That if you take what little we know about Jesus, that he was a Jew, that he started a Jewish movement, the purpose of which was to establish the kingdom of God on earth, and that as a result of that movement, he was captured by Rome, tortured, and executed as a state criminal. If you take those three things...
Okay, so these are the only three things he's saying we can know about Jesus: that he was a Jew, that he started a movement, and that he was crucified. This is an example of historical minimalism. One of the things that bothers me when I read many of the people who have written about the life of Jesus post-Enlightenment since 1800 is that there's such skepticism about ancient historical record that essentially they would argue we can't know anything about anyone. And I know when I taught the Life of Jesus class here at the community college last semester, I started off by asking the students, what do we know about Abraham Lincoln? I asked them, how many of you believe there was a man named Abraham Lincoln who was the 16th president of the United States and led the country during a time of civil war and issued the Emancipation Proclamation? And then I asked them, and everyone said, yes, yes, we believe that. And then I asked them, how do you know? Have you ever met Abraham Lincoln? Have you ever seen him? Have you ever heard him give a speech? And the answer was no. And how do we know anything about Abraham Lincoln? Well, we have a historical record. We have evidences from people who were eyewitnesses to his life. We also have the reality of the impact of his life, in that we have a nation that has been shaped by him and his actions as a leader. And there's sometimes with the study of the life of Jesus, there's such hyper skepticism that they would make it sound like we can't know anything about Jesus. And if we use this kind of standard, then they would say, I guess we can't know anything about Julius Caesar. We can't know anything about Alexander the Great. We can't know anything about Socrates. And perhaps they would say that. They're such minimalists. Perhaps they would say that. But I think that's taking things too far. It's too skeptical. Yes, we can know something about the historical Jesus. We have, in particular, four canonical gospels that record his life, and we can trust their historical reliability.
And you place them in this world in which Jesus lived, era awash in apocalyptic expectation, then in a way, his biography kind of writes itself. And then you can use the Gospels, the New Testament, to sort of fill in the holes, as long as you make sure to test the claims of the Gospels through the lens of the history that we are familiar with.
So he wants us to start with, I guess, the cultural milieu of the first century. But the problem is that outside of the Gospels, there are only a precious few historical references to Jesus from his contemporaries. Anybody who teaches New Testament, early Christianity, you know, it's standard to say, you know, there are only a handful of sources. One of those I've already mentioned is the writer Tacitus, who briefly mentions the life of Jesus. There are two references in Josephus. There is one brief reference in the Roman historian Suetonius, one brief reference to Christians in a letter from a man named Pliny to the Emperor Trajan in the early 2nd century. Outside of that, our foundational source for the life of Jesus is found in the four canonical Gospels. And he makes it sound as though we have all this information and we can use the Gospels to fill in the gaps. And in truth, it's exactly the opposite. We have the Gospels as the foundation, and then we have other bits of information that we can use to fill in the gaps.
I wonder if there's another detail that you could share with us from your research, something about Jesus, his life, his growing up, that might run counter to popular conceptions of him.
Oh, there's so much. The first gospel, the Gospel of Mark, which was written in around 70 or 71 CE.
Let me stop here. This is another big assumption, and this is one that you'll typically hear in anyone doing New Testament studies. He assumes what is called Markan priority. He assumes Mark is the first gospel. This is indeed the reigning opinion among most New Testament scholars. However, it is a fairly recent opinion. It's only been a view that has been accepted since the mid-19th century. In fact, if you go back earlier in Christian history, for the longest period of time, most people believed that Matthew was the earliest gospel, so-called Matthean priority. St. Augustine of Hippo held this view. It's sometimes called the Augustinian proposal. He would have held that the Gospels were written in the order that they appear in the canon: Matthew first, then Mark, then Luke, and then John. In the mid-19th century, there came to be a focus upon Mark for various reasons, that it was believed to be the most primitive. I think in large part because it was the briefest of the four Gospels, and there was a theory that the Gospels, that Mark was the first Gospel. And then it had been expanded upon by Matthew and Luke. They, if you know what it's called, the four-source hypothesis, that Matthew and Luke used Mark, and then they used another hypothetical document that is called Q. That theory became the reigning theory, popularized by a fellow named B.H. Streeter. in the early 20th century, but it is by no means the opinion of all interpreters, even all interpreters who are doing mainstream academic research. There was a man named William Farmer who in the late 20th century argued vigorously for the what was called the Griesbach hypothesis, the revival of the Griesbach hypothesis, that Matthew was the first gospel. There's absolutely nothing within the Gospels that tell us that Mark, without a shadow of a doubt, was the first gospel. Many people believe that to be true, but there's no way to prove that inconclusively. He's also making a similar argument we've already responded to, that Mark is post 70, which again would be very much up to challenge.
It's unusual in that there is actually no statement of messianic identity from Jesus in it. From the beginning of the gospel to the end of the gospel, at no point does Jesus ever actually say, "I am the Messiah."
Whoops, let's stop right here. This is another a common road that is taken by many who study with skepticism the Gospels. And it's really an astounding statement, and I think a misreading of the Gospel of Mark. Yes, Jesus does not outright say, as recorded in Mark's Gospel, "I am the Christ." But how does the Gospel of Mark begin? The Gospel of Mark begins in Mark chapter 1 and verse 1, "The beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ, the Son of God." And so from the very beginning, Mark tells us that he's writing a gospel, a declaration of good news, a euangelion, about Jesus the Christ, the Christos, the Messiah. And then he uses definite reserve, I think because he accurately reflects what was going on in the life of the historical Jesus. And the high point of Mark's gospel comes in Mark chapter 8, when at Caesarea Philippi, Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do people say that I am?" And then he asked them, "Who do you say that I am?" And for the first time in the gospel, we have Peter responding in Mark 8:29 and saying to Jesus, "You are the Christ, you are the Christos." And that is the high point of the gospel, is that confession by Peter that Jesus is the Christ. Then at the very end of the gospel, after Jesus has been crucified, the centurion stands opposite of him in Mark 15, verse 39, and says, "Truly, this man was the Son of God." So it would be inaccurate to say that Mark's gospel does not have a concern to present Jesus as the Christ. Perhaps there isn't a place directly in Mark where Jesus says, "I am the Christ." But let's look at the whole witness of the rest of the gospels. Think about Jesus in John's gospel, who says in John 10:30, "I and my Father are one." Or the Jesus who says in John 14:6, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me." And then if we take the entire New Testament as being the words, the Word of God, what is the proclamation of the apostles? It is that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. And so it would be inaccurate to say that Mark does not confess Jesus to be the Christ, or present Jesus as denying that he is the Christ.
On the contrary, he keeps denying it when other people claim the Messiah for him. This is a phenomenon that scholars refer to as the messianic secret. And
let me pause right here. Yes, there was a scholar, I think 1901. His name was William Vreda, a German, and he wrote a book called The Messianic Secret. And he took the places where Jesus urges people he's healed or demons and tells them not to let others know that he is the Christ. And Vreda grabbed this and he made the argument that later Christians, when they wrote the gospel, the historical Jesus had never claimed to be the Christ. And later gospel writers falsely fabricated the idea of Jesus being the Christ. But in order to explain why Jesus had never explicitly said this during his ministry, they created this motif of the messianic secret. The problem with this is there's a very simple explanation for why Jesus might have told people on different occasions not to announce that he is the Christ, mainly because he did not want them to misunderstand how he conceived himself as the Christ, that he was not coming as a political figure to establish a temporal kingdom, and also perhaps that he knew that they did not understand that he was going to be a Christ and a king that they had not anticipated, a suffering Messiah. And so Mr. Aslan follows down a well-worn path, following in the footsteps of Vreda, I think, in misunderstanding and misconstruing the point of the so-called messianic secret motif in the Gospels.
I think it's the key to sort of getting at something that is almost inaccessible to us. We know how Jesus' followers viewed him. We know how Jesus' enemies viewed him. But we don't know how Jesus viewed himself. And I think that...
This is another... Again, a very common approach to Jesus after the Enlightenment. It's a very modern approach, and that is to ask, how did Jesus view himself? What was Jesus' self-consciousness? Did Jesus have a messianic self-consciousness? And in many ways, again, it's a very anachronistic question because the gospel writers were not psychologists, and they do not present Jesus as if he were in some kind of angst about trying to figure out who he was or who he is. So it's an anachronistic question. I think we have to go to the places where Jesus explicitly declares himself to be one with the Father, where he exclusively proclaims himself to be the servant who has come to give his life as a ransom for many, and we can see that Jesus saw himself as the Messiah, understood himself to be the Messiah, without having what some appear to want him to have, and that is some kind of angst about his messianic self-consciousness.
Within this messianic secret is a clue that whether Jesus actually thought he was the Messiah or not, he understood something profound, which is that in first century Palestine, simply saying the words, "I am the Messiah," is a treasonable offense. Saying that "I am here to establish God's rule on earth" is equivalent to saying, "I am here to remove Caesar from power." And whether Jesus actually believed he was the Messiah or not, in a sense, he may have been smart enough not to make such a big deal about it.
Again, I think he misunderstands the Jesus of the Gospels and the Jesus of history. Yes, there were people like the Romans, like Pilate, who saw Jesus as a threat because he talked about the kingdom of God. But the primary thing that Jesus did to offend people of his own time, particularly his fellow Jews, was that he claimed for himself an equality of essence with the God of the Bible, the God of the Hebrew Bible. And this is what led to his crucifixion. He was not a political zealot, but he was the Messiah, the Christ of God. And so this was the primary thing that became the issue that led to conflict and led to his rejection by men.
Are you still a Christian? No, I wouldn't call myself a Christian because I do not believe that Jesus is God, nor do I believe that he ever thought that he was God.
I appreciate his honest response. Yes, obviously he is not a Christian. If he does not believe that Jesus is Lord, that Jesus is God, and that was the primitive confession, biblical confession, Romans 10:9. If you confess with your mouth the Lord Jesus and believe in your heart that God has raised him from the dead, you will be saved. And yes, I'm thankful for this honest answer. By that definition, by biblical definition, he is not a Christian. even if at one time, apparently earlier in his life, he professed himself to be a Christian.
Or that he ever said that he was God. But I am a follower of Jesus, and I think that sometimes, unfortunately, I think even Christians would recognize this and admit it, those two things aren't always the same.
So, yes, can you be a follower of Jesus and be a Christian and not be a Christian? And I guess by that he means he's attempting to follow the ethical teachings of Jesus. I guess that's what most people mean by that. And yes, Jesus did teach many important things. He taught the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. He taught that man's chief end is to love God with all his heart, mind, soul, and strength, and love his neighbor, love your neighbor as yourself. Can you really be a Christian? Can you really be a follower of Jesus if you reject the primary things that Jesus taught about himself? Jesus taught, if anyone would come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross daily and follow me. Again, Jesus taught, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. Are you really a follower of Jesus if you reject the claims that Jesus made about himself? You know, I would prefer somebody would be honest in not only saying, I'm not a Christian because I don't believe Jesus is God, but also in saying, I'm not a Christian because I'm not in agreement with what Jesus taught about the way to live my life.
Being a Christian and being a follower of Jesus.
Reza Aslan is the author of a new book called Zealot, The Life and Times of Jesus of Nazareth. He joined us from NPR West.
All right, that's the end of the interview. And this has gone a lot longer than I thought it was going to. It's been an hour and 15 minutes that I've been sitting here reviewing this 9-minute clip. I had a lot to say. A couple things I would say in closing. I mean, one thing this is a reminder for us of is that we ought to take care in the way we do evangelism with young people. This man was falsely evangelized as a teenager. He was given false assurance, and then he goes off to college and he loses his so-called faith. And I think it's a reminder that we need to be very careful in preaching the gospel and testing to make sure and seeing fruit and seeing evidence, particularly in young people, before we pronounce that they are believers. And then secondly, it's a reminder that we need to be very discerning about what we read when somebody comes out with a biography of Jesus. As I noted already, there's really nothing new in what Mr. Aslan has written about Jesus. What he's writing and what he's saying can be traced right back to a man named Hermann Samuel Reimarus, who first wrote and challenged the historicity of the Gospels and gave a reinterpretation of the Gospels. His views were published after his death because they would have been so scandalous in his lifetime. And then numerous other people in the rational, historical, critical train have said similar things, all the way up to Albert Schweitzer, who wrote The Quest of the Historical Jesus, who argued that Jesus was a failed apocalyptic prophet, all the way up through the 1980s when we had the so-called Jesus Seminar with Robert Funk, saying that Jesus hadn't really said the things that are attributed to him in the Gospels. This is really nothing new. It's so interesting that places like NPR present this as something that's cutting edge and new. Really, these ideas are things that are, you know, 300 years old or so, but they're being presented as something new. And so we need to use discernment and when we hear these sorts of things. And we need to test these things by logic. We need to test them by the Gospels. And we need to test them by what faithful interpreters of the Scriptures have said. Well, that's enough Word Magazine for today. And again, I hope maybe I'll be able to do another one of these. And there won't be such a gap before the next one. Take care and God bless. Just throw.